We're going to change the order slightly here to accommodate some folks that are busily at work in other areas. Going to invite former Senator Troll and Representative Haas to come up and talk about Senate Bill 75. We're opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 75. As soon as Senator Morris gets here, we will move him into this discussion.
Okay, Mr. Chair, it's good to see you again.
Good
to see you. Thank you for inviting us to come up. Senator Deckard, Senator Farioli, greetings. I'm here not as an expert on this bill, but as somebody who wants to speak to the spirit behind the bill. We've moved in education at the public school level to establish standards for teaching in a number of different areas, as you know. The SIM has a whole group of standards, clearly, that are mandated. I know you're dealing with that issue, and I know there's going to be some changing and so forth. But the principle of establishing those standards as expectation for high-quality teaching is a very important principle. And the bill, Senate Bill 75, relates to that principle. It simply says that in the area of health education, that there should be standards created. In fact, there are already national standards that could be adopted by the State Department. This is not a tremendously restrictive mandate that we're putting on school districts at this point. But we are saying that those standards ought to be adopted and approved and made available, so that people know what they are, and then they can be used to improve the quality of the health education in our schools. There are plenty of reasons for doing that. If you look at the health condition in the state for young people, you find there are serious health needs, and they need good education in that area. So I commend Senator Morissette, who's the sponsor of this bill, and he knows a lot more about it than I do, so save your hard questions for him.
Thank you, Senator Trump.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Now we have Senator Bill Morissette here.
Mark.
He's deferring to you, so
I will move, and you can have the seat here.
Mark, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'm grateful to you for hearing this bill and to Senator Morissette, and it's an honor to be here with former Senator Troll. Oregon leads this country in a couple of very dubious categories. We're not only the hungriest state in this country, we also have one of the highest rates of obesity for young people. You've probably heard or seen the statistics that unhealthy eating habits and physical inactivity rival smoking as one of the leading causes of death in our country, contributing upwards of 500,000 deaths each year in the U.S. Better health education gives kids the tools to make healthier eating decisions, among other things. Quality health education will also help kids learn more about the risks associated with drinking, smoking, and drugs. Research is very strong on this point. The more education young people have on the dangers of drugs, the less likely they are to abuse them. I just believe that if kids are taught at an early age about the need to live healthy lives, they're much more likely to be successful. When our children succeed, we all succeed. So our investment in healthy kids today will pay dividends tomorrow by avoiding the costs of treating disease, drug addiction, and depression. To me, this bill is an investment in healthy children and a healthy future. And I encourage your support, and I thank you.
Representative, we need your name for the record.
And you have to repeat everything.
Okay. About my name is Mark Haas from House District 27.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Questions?
Good to see these two guys.
Thank you.
Well, did you have the amendments?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to go ahead and read the amendments?
I don't really know what they do.
Don, would you come forward, please, and
yes.
And testify about the amendments?
Oh,
Please, Don.
Let me explain for just a moment. I have been in committee for the last 2 hours. There have been a lot of things happening quickly in terms, including the amendments, which were written just not too long ago because they were messed up. And so Don Bischoff is my assistant who's been working on this, and I would like to have Don explain the amendments.
So Mr. Chair, my name is Don Bischoff. I'm legislative assistant to Senator Bill Morsett, who delights in putting me on the spot at the last minute without telling me in advance. There has been a scramble on the amendments because there was an unforeseen delay in getting the amendments back from legislative council, and then when we got the first set, there was an unintended insertion. So what you should have before you are -2 and -3 amendments. And what you will notice is that there is no mention of the magic word SIM or CAM anywhere in the bill as amended by -2 and -3. The -3 amendment removes the SIM-CAM reference from the original bill and substitutes language from the Department of Education to have the department adopt standards for the state schools based on the National Health Education Standards. You should have a copy of those standards in the packet that's with Senator Morsett's letterhead explanation. We've worked closely with the Department of Education to minimize any fiscal impact from the bill. The department plans to use a grant from the federal Centers for Disease Control to cover virtually all the costs of implementing the bill. If there are any lingering printing costs, and we think there will be very few, if any, because of the use of an electronic system that the department will testify about, it's the department's intent, our intent, and the intent of supporters of the bill to raise funds privately to cover whatever those minimal costs might be. And it's to that end that the -2 amendment has been adopted. We perceive no need for any additional general fund money to cover the cost of this bill. And so it's the senator's hope that the committee would approve the -2 and -3 amendments, remove the referral to Ways and Means, and send the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Any questions?
Thank you.
It was my pleasure, Senator.
Thank you very much.
That's why we pay you the big bucks. Thank you very much.
I don't seem to have the -2 or 3 amendments. So
they were paper-clipped.
They were paper-clipped.
To Senator Morsett's letterhead right here.
Okay. And there.
He's
not
there.
Not there. Okay. Thank you very much. All right. We got a number of people signed up here. Before we bring people up, because of the changes in the bill, I'm going to open a work session and move the amendments to the bill so that we're talking to the Senator Becker or Morsett. I'd like to move the amendments to the Senate Bill 75, so we're talking about the amended bill.
Yes, I would move -2 amendments and -3 amendments to Senate Bill 75.
Can we do that in one motion?
I will move -2 amendments to Senate Bill 75.
Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Okay, I would move -3 amendments to Senate Bill 75.
Senator Morsett has moved the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 75. Any objection? Not so ordered. We will close the work session, reopen a public hearing on Senate Bill 75, which now is amended by the -2 and 3 amendments. With that, I hope folks have copies of those. We're going to invite Alita Haas Holcomb. John Valley, Gillian Davis. Come up and occupy our three chairs and proceed to give us your names and your testimony, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Alita Haas Holcomb, and I'm with the Oregon Alliance for Health and Physical Education, Recreation, and Dance. Today, I think we're all here to because we care about the quality of education for our students in Oregon, and I'm here especially to advocate for the positive influence that health education standards will have on our quest to educate the whole child and prepare a citizenry that is knowledgeable in areas of wellness and that demonstrates behaviors that contribute to healthy quality living. Health education is not a luxury, and well-trained health educators are essentialists. However, the journey to bring official health education standards to help guide these teachers in their critical role has been a long road. While other curriculum areas were having official Oregon standards and benchmarks published in the official Oregon Standards newsletter, which I've brought one here, this is the most one of the recent ones, health education was relegated to a lower status where there was brief mention to the state was given to what the State Department referred to as common curriculum goals. And in addition to having no official state standards to assist teachers in their critical roles, the situation sent a wrong message to administrators saying that accountability for this curricular area wasn't really a priority. And the result that we've seen is a steady decline in quality health education across the state. To the credit of concerned health educators in the state, OFERD's Association for the Advancement of Health Education developed in 1998 a resource based on the National Health Education Standards. And I have a copy of it here. It's been around a long time. This service to teachers was a positive step forward. However, without official ODE recognition of standards for this curricular area, the effectiveness of this resource, although it was a good resource, was really sort of at a disadvantage. Senate Bill 75 has the potential to make quality health education for Oregon and for all of Oregon students a real priority by directing the Department of Ed to establish the National Health Education Standards as the statewide standard. The status and the quality of this curricular area will be enhanced. The structure for training and technical assistance to school districts and public charter schools is already really in place. Being number one in obesity is not a record that the state of Oregon wants to keep. It's truly time to step up to the plate and score big time for creating a framework to make all of our students winners. Quality health education based on the National Health Education Standards will play a key part in building a solid future. And I want to end with a quote from the American Medical Association. Quote, "It is the growing belief that any future advances made in improving the nation's health will not result from spectacular biomedical breakthroughs. Rather, advances will result from personally initiated actions that are directly influenced by the individual's health-related attitudes, beliefs, and knowledge. School health education can make a valuable contribution in areas such as these and can play an important role in improving the quality of living," unquote. And I have copies that I'll turn in. And I also have some statement from the Oregon Dairy Council. They were unable to be here today, so I'll turn those in at this time as well.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the testimony. Any questions?
Hi, my name is John Valley, and I am the Advocacy Director here in Oregon for the American Heart Association. I have also submitted some written testimony from the Oregon Association of Health Educators who weren't able to be here today, as well as some concerned teachers and parents. So those will be shared with the committee. And from there, I'll start on my testimony. I'd like to thank the chairman and the committee for the opportunity to testify today. The American Heart Association supports Senate Bill 75 and the amendments offered by Senator Morissette. We recognize the importance of having a quality, comprehensive health education in fighting heart disease and stroke, and believe that Senate Bill 75 provides an important step in reaching that goal. Health education is the only required academic subject in Oregon that does not have state standards. Even though poor eating habits contribute significantly to the development of obesity, high blood pressure, and heart disease. Senate Bill 75, along with the amendments offered by Senator Morissette, will establish the National Health Education Standards as the statewide standards for the health education in Oregon. This is important because part of those standards address the nutritional concerns impacting the state. Currently in Oregon, 28% of 8th graders and 21% of 11th graders are overweight. Between 1994 and 2001, obesity among Oregon adults had increased by 59%. Oregon's adult obesity rate is at 22%, the highest in any state west of the Rockies. Add to that the 38% of Oregon adults who are overweight, and we have a total of 60% of Oregon adults who are not at a healthy weight. And there is a distinction between overweight and obesity, if anyone wants to go into that. There is a distinction, but unfortunately Oregon is not as trim as we should be, is the bottom line. According to the Centers for Disease Control, among U.S. adults in 1996, $31 billion of treatment costs for cardiovascular disease was related to obesity and being overweight. Obesity is fast approaching tobacco use as the number one preventable cause of heart disease and stroke. The data shows that Oregon and the United States as a whole is facing an obesity crisis. Senate Bill 75 is a small but significant attempt in addressing that crisis in Oregon. Now is the time to provide quality health education standards to improve the health of the state and specifically improve the health of Oregon's young people. By having statewide health education standards, we are in a better position to have a healthier populace. And I'd just like to add, as far as the amendments go, I know there was a lot of craziness going on today to get the language down, but I feel very confident, and I think the department will testify to this a little bit later, that the costs are covered by a CDC grant that the state has to help implement these standards and bring schools aligned to those standards. And I'm not the expert on that, but I feel confident that the costs are going to be minimal, and this is such an important step for the future of Oregon that we really encourage the committee to support this bill. And I'll end there, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that people might have. Thank you.
Any questions?
I have a quick question. Did you, at some point along the way in this discussion, say that you also might have access to grants?
I believe one of the amendments, and I forget if it's the dash 3 or the dash 2, talk about the department as well as supporters of the bill looking for outside resources to help fund the printing costs, which based on the department's fiscal impact would be the costs associated with implementing this legislation. And that we would be actively, we've already drafted letters to private companies who would be potentially willing to support paying for those one-time printing costs. So we are in the process of doing that and looking into our own organizations who have made health education a priority.
I guess my question was, in our conversation, was that there would be no general fund cost
exactly,
for this bill. And if the money was not available to do complete the work that was to be done, it would be done as money was available.
That's my understanding, yes, Senator Morris.
Thank you very much.
Yes, please.
My name's Jillian Davis, and I'm a high school teacher. I'm a health teacher and a health occupation teacher at Benson High School in Portland. And I'm also the mother of three teenagers, and those things are important. From a teacher's point of view, I have greatly appreciated being able to align health-related curriculum to the standards. And for one, if just for one very important reason, that it puts in focus or in the correct balance the need for for information, and then which is a small amount of information, and then reminds us that what children need is time to develop skills. It's what kids know is very important, but what they're able to do, including communicate, make decisions, things like that, goal setting, is actually how students gain the skills they can to be healthy adults. And so with the standards really helps teachers align curriculum in a way that provides not just information and facts about things, but time to develop the skills. And it helps us as teachers then assess true learning around health, which is what kids are able to do. What do? How does their lifestyle change towards a lifelong healthy, a long healthy life, I guess. And then as a parent, I have a 19-year-old, 16-year-old, and a 13-year-old. The 19-year-old, you know, it's tough having those kids at that age, and some of you may have had them. And really, what helps kids be able to make healthier decisions in difficult moments is having already developed those skills. It's too late, you know, when you're in that critical place at having to make a difficult decision. You have to practice those skills beforehand. And I've watched my own children do that, and I think that that this will really help teachers across the state be able to provide that for all kids, which is my goal as a health teacher. Thank you. Do you have any questions, Anna?
Any questions? Thank you. Okay. We're going to move on. I have a very capable committee administrator informed me that I stepped over the line, and I apologize for that. I moved amendments when I had no work session scheduled, and so I'm properly chastised.
We won't do anything yet.
Can we publicly chastise you? Or
That's all right. I can stand it. We will continue. Jenny Ehrlich, Oregon Department of Education, Leslie Hickok, I believe it's Courtney Dresser. Please. All right. Give us your name and testimony, please.
Chairman Starr and members of the committee, my name is Jenny Ehrlich, and I'm the team leader for the Healthy Kids Learn Better partnership at the Oregon Department of Education. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. The Department of Education supports Senate Bill 75 with the amendments that were offered by Senator Morsette. The Oregon Department of Education supports this bill because healthy kids do learn better, and quality health education program is an integral part of building the knowledge and skills necessary for our children and youth to adopt healthy behaviors and avoid the risks often associated with adolescence. Research has linked quality health education programs with increased physical activity and decreased substance abuse and the likelihood of behavioral referrals and suspensions among students. Not only have the quality health education programs been linked to more positive health behaviors, they've also been shown to increase math and reading scores among elementary school students and increase the likelihood of high school completion among older students. Recently in Oregon, we have left health education behind, failing to require that schools base instruction on rigorous standards, like is happening in other subject areas. Health education is currently the only required subject area without state content standards. As a result, the 2002 School Health Programs and Policy Study revealed that only 1 in 4 health educators use a standards-based approach in their classrooms, and that there was a broad variance in the use of strategies that comprise an effective health education program. This study also showed a decline in the use of skills-based health education practices from 1998 to 2002 in Oregon's classrooms. Instead, instruction is more likely to be focused solely on health information. I'm sure that we can all think of health information that we know are good practices, such as daily flossing, regular exercise, and limiting intake of certain foods. I'm also fairly certain that many of us wish we had the opportunity to develop early on the skills to better implement these health habits. Without a stronger state policy, these very important skills-based health education programs will most likely continue to decline. Adoption of the national health education standards as Oregon's content standards will greatly enhance the quality of health education programs in Oregon schools. These standards focus primarily on the development of life skills, such as the ability to refuse risky behavior, access valid health information, and analyze influences of peers, media, and technology facing many of our youth every day. These standards are aligned to what research has found to be best practice. The National Health Education Standards also provide room for local decision-making because the standards focus on the development of essential life skills. Local school districts will still be able to make decisions in partnership with their local communities on the specific content and developmentally appropriate timing of specific health topics. Lastly, the National Health Education Standards and health education in general enjoy widespread public support. In a 1998 national opinion poll on essential learnings for K-12 education conducted by the Mid-Continental Regional Educational Laboratory revealed that the vast majority of respondents said that health education is an essential part of a well-rounded education. Many of you are probably wondering about the fiscal impact of this bill. The good news is that the Oregon Department of Education can support most of the costs and possibly all of the costs to a general generous grant from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The Oregon Department of Education has recently shifted to an electronic system for distributing information and resources to districts, with hard copies available upon request for districts unable to access information electronically. If districts are amenable to the use of this distribution system for the National Health Education Standards, there would be no fiscal impact for this bill. If each school district were to require a hard copy of the standards, there would be an approximate $20,000 cost to this bill that would need to be covered through another source of revenue. Our support is based on the assumption that either the electronic distribution version is acceptable or we receive additional funding from another source. The Oregon Department of Education believes that quality health education programs that encourage and build skills for healthy behaviors are a very important part of overall quality education, and we encourage you to support Senate Bill 75. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you, Jenny. Any questions? Okay.
Next. Good afternoon. I'm Leslie Hickox. I'm a health and education instructor here in the state of Oregon at Portland Community College. I have taught health education in the secondary, college, and teacher preparation levels in the states of New York, Montana, Illinois, and Oregon throughout the past 25 years. I'm very committed to the purpose and implementation of Senate Bill 75 throughout the state of Oregon. Having taught in Oregon for over 14 years and experienced its commitment to continuing teaching health at the secondary and college levels, it is very relevant that we now adopt these national health education standards for our schools. As a representative of the American Association of Health Education and the Oregon Association of Health Education, I see that it is imperative that Oregon officially adopt these national health education standards, if only to be up to date with the majority of states. Having confirmed with the director of the American Association of Health Education, Dr. Becky Smith, in Reston, Virginia, over 35 states have adopted or adapted the National Health Education Standards. The National Health Education Standards are performance-based, as my other colleagues have described with the skill development. The standards are accepted by NCATE, the National Board for Teacher Education Accreditation. It is also urged by both AHE, Association of Health Education, and NASPE, the National Association of Physical Education, the two key professional health and physical education associations in part responsible for the standards, that the standards in health and PE remain separate entities. The urgent need for the adoption of the National Health Education Standards and training of public school teachers for effective K through 12 health education has significant long-term medical, economic, and overall societal impact on the state and citizens of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
One question.
Oh, Marcia.
Where did you teach in Montana?
I've heard you're a Montana native. Actually, Southwest Montana at Western Montana College. Was there. True.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. For the record, my name is Courtney Dresser. I am the advocacy manager for the American Cancer Society here in Oregon, and a graduate of Carroll College in Helena, Montana.
Oh, wow.
But I am Oregonian.
Getting closer.
I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 75 with the amendments. And you have my testimony. Basically, you've heard that this is the only course that doesn't have any standards here in the state. You've heard the rates in regards to obesity in the state. We also have 60,000 Oregon youth who still use some form of tobacco in the state. Behaviors such as tobacco use, poor eating habits, and physical inactivity increase a child's chance of getting cancer as an adult. And we also know that almost two-thirds of cancers could be prevented if behaviors such as these were never started. The National Health Education Standards will help students develop numerous skills, which I've listed, and the most important thing to me is becoming a lifelong advocate for better health. Basically, the sooner we can teach these children these healthy lifestyle choices, the more chance they'll be becoming healthy adults and continue to be healthy adults. For the Cancer Society, the evidence is easy for us to understand. 1/3 of all cancer deaths are related to diet and activity factors. That's about 186,000 lives per year in the United States. Cancers such as breast cancer, cancer of the esophagus, and colon cancer all have links to poor health factors, too. So that's one of the reasons they're developed. We need to develop lifelong and life-sustaining healthy behaviors in our children today. In the end, this will help save lives and save us money down the road. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I should just note that Ms. Dresser worked with me in the past and made me look very, very good last session. It's good to see her in a new role and bigger and better things.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, our final witnesses signed up here, Chuck Bennett and Wayne Feller.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I think I'm about to have my faith reaffirmed in human nature and the processes that are in play in this building. So I'll be interested in this next testing.
Very good, Senator Ferrioli.
Yes. Chairman Starr and committee, for the record, I'm Wayne Feller. I'm a member of the State Board of Education for the last 6 years, and for the last 4 years I've been part of the Healthy School Network, which is sponsored by the CDC, a group of 11 states who are interested in healthy schools. And I'd like to say at meetings we've heard from the states of Missouri, North Carolina, Kentucky, and Michigan who have well-developed health education programs, and they are really showing positive results, they feel, from this. As has been mentioned before, physical activity, nutrition, tobacco, and alcohol use are a problem in Oregon. And as a practicing dentist for the last 35 years, I can assure you that cost control of health costs in Oregon can be helped greatly by preventive programs which have as a basis health education. And I'm here mostly not to give you any data, because Jenny Ehrlich, who has been working with us, has a wealth of information that she has shared some of with you, and I'm sure she could help you much more. I'm here mostly to give you the keynote from the state board member that healthy kids learn better. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Question.
Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett, Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, there is no doubt that healthy children learn better. We have support health education. We are always interested in improving curriculum, setting higher standards for young people. But, Mr. Chairman, we're looking at Senate Bill 75 unamended. I apologize. These amendments arrived at our hands as we arrived through the door, and we are just having a chance to kind of get them internalized and take a look at what they mean. We are very, very concerned about additional mandates. We sat through hearings for the past several days down in the Ways and Means Committee and the Subcommittee on Education, and listened as teachers, parents, students, administrators, and citizens at large described the failing condition of the schools right now. The number of teachers that are about to be laid off as a result of the failure of the economy to support the level of funding we've been experiencing for the past several years, and as we spiral in, we're very concerned about adding anything that resembles a mandate, and realize now that you have something else in mind here. We would like to have a chance to take a look at what that means relative to any kind of mandate. At the same time, Mr. Chairman, we are looking at bills throughout the building, particularly on the other side, that try to address the future of SIM and CAM. We have a bill that is being worked on now that we would ask you to take a look at, possibly for dealing with this issue. House Bill 2744 is in the House Education Committee. It's trying to align SIM and standards and No Child Left Behind. There's a work session on the bill next week that might even be a better place where this can be looked at in a more complete and holistic context, where we see it in relation to other programs. Again, Mr. Chairman, it is certainly not to detract from this particular subject area or to suggest that we shouldn't have the very best health education available if we could only add and only include health education in our curriculum. The question we're getting down to, and I've been in front of you before with this same message, we're getting down to, will we be teaching reading, writing, and arithmetic, and is that a basic education in Oregon that you all are willing to send out to the people of this state and suggest to them that's an adequate education? We're losing foreign languages. We're losing physical education. We heard about districts that are losing their entire extracurricular programs in Washington County, the economic engine of this state, under a $4.6 billion allocation. It, again, all of this just keeps coming down to money. There isn't enough to meet all of these demands, and as we can deal with this, we certainly will be interested in it. Again, Mr. Chairman, I'm speaking to the bill that I saw come out, not to the amendments, and I'll take a closer look at the amendments, but we're just concerned about this generally, and I also don't want to pass up the opportunity to complain again about $4.6 billion and what it's going to do to public education in this state if we don't start talking about some sort of additional revenue. Thank you.
May I ask a question?
Senator Morissette.
Mr. Bennett, you, I'm sure, don't have a problem with trying to access money from other sources, like the Center for Disease Control and for the Heart Association, from the Heart Association, and from any community resource that we can get. I mean, that's not a problem, right?
No, sir. We are interested in accessing, but we are interested in accessing so many dollars right now from so many broad sources. But no, we're not questioning that either. My colleague from Portland Public Schools is actually prepared to speak to that whole part of the question, if that's
okay.
Well, but certainly I wouldn't disagree with you, sir.
Well, I'll get back to you in just a minute.
No, I thought you might.
Further questions?
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm Patty O'Sullivan, Portland Public Schools, and I concur with everything Chuck said. I have had a little more opportunity. I think I read quicker. I'm not sure. To look at the amendments. And Senator Morissette, what I'm understanding is that the entire sections 2, paren 1 and 2 are being paid for by a CDC grant and some donations from the Heart Association or some in-kind work. It's really paragraph 3 that we're concerned about in the amendments, and I think there's a pretty easy fix, and it's the dash threes. What happens is you set up adopting academic content standards in Section 1, and then you say the department shall train people and pass the information out, and you've got the money covered for that. But Section 3 then says we shall align those new content standards with our academic content standards that we do or don't have at this point. We're required to have some things taught in health, but we don't really know what it would be included in these new content standards. So you may be setting us up not to have the required and appropriate teachers to teach this. It may take so much more class time that we need more classes and teachers we don't have and money we don't have to pay for new teachers. So we're very concerned that the shall in paren 3 really is an unfunded mandate. I don't know that for a fact, but we're concerned about letting this go through with a shall. If you had the shall changed to a may, which said that once these curriculum standards are set up and the training is available and the material is available and a district wants to avail themselves of that training and technical assistance assistance from the department, then they may. And so that's really where we're coming from. Then that changes it from every school district having to do something that at this point is sort of unknown entity to once it's set up, we can avail of ourselves of that help. And then once funding gets better, we hope that everybody would avail themselves of that. But at this point, we're just like up here. Senator Deckert already knows how we're dealing with one of his bills. It seemed easy, but it was also a bit of an unfunded mandate, and we have to stay on it because there's just not enough money to spread around. So that's really my testimony. We're very supportive of this. In fact, I'm so sore from racquetball and bowling that health is really on my mind right now.
John,
thank you. Senator Morissette?
Yes, Mr. Bennett, would you sit in the back row?
I sure will.
And good. Just right back there. And would Jenny Ehrlich come up? Jenny? You're not far away. You can come back. Yeah. did you hear the suggestion from Shell
for
May?
Chairman Starr, members of the committee, we did hear the suggestion, and what we would like to do is possibly spend some time having a discussion, perhaps before our work session, to talk more further about that with the districts.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions? Senator Ferriobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, my faith in human nature has, in fact, been reaffirmed. We've had lots of discussions in this building, both in this session and in previous sessions, about mandated curriculums. I was sort of having an Eddie Eagle deja vu thing happening here, and we did, in fact, pass out some mandated curriculum on phonics in the previous legislative session. And I see the issue is really two different issues. One, of course, is the issue of whether or not these new curriculums will cost money, and they will certainly cost money, and it isn't a matter of just getting the stuff printed. It's a matter of reintegrating or integrating the stuff into the flow of the day in the curriculum. And correlation of curriculum isn't just done at the head office. It's done in the lesson plans of the students. So it's a lot of hassle. The other issue, I think, is just the whole idea of mandated curriculums. I keep hearing from my school district people, would I just please quit that, adopting mandates? This is still good curriculum, and it's still a good public purpose. I also am concerned about the amendment in Dash 3, Mr. Chairman. The shall and may, according to the Legislative Council, I've been told is absolutely the same, and if you want to make this stuff optional, you have to be more specific than leaving it to shall or may. You have to just say this curriculum shall be optional, and that way you don't leave any ambiguity about the intentions. So it just one of those situations. I've expressed my support to the proponents for this bill, so I'll have to go back with my head hung with to school district administrators and say, I did it to you again, mandated another curriculum. But I think we ought to try and give the folks some relief on this issue and make it, if you intend to make it optional, then we ought to say that out loud.
May I?
Senator,
yes.
Morissette.
I don't have a problem with the optional part of it. And as a teacher of social studies in the high secondary level for 30 years, and one who did teach state and local government, and I taught 6 weeks of it, and I could not get my colleagues to, even though there was not a mention of state and local government in the state curriculum. It was all local. And I did finally get the state to put in the word state and local in the government requirement, and that did make a difference. So I think that even though this is not a requirement to have it in the curriculum guide and to urge people to do it, and as time goes on, more of them will, I think it's extremely important to move this forward, and I don't have a problem with the continued conversation to work out the concerns about mandates and so on, but I think that we need guidance, and I think this bill does give guidance to health education. So I'm happy to do that.
Further comments? Hearing none. The public hearing, since we have not scheduled a work session, we will not go back to a work session. And
They're ready.
I now open a work session on the only bill we have scheduled for work session, Senate Bill 437.
It's kind of confusing, but that's okay.
And we have had numerous amendments, lots of discussion. Senator Deckert has been working on this. Senator Deckert, would you tell us about the Dash 13 amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and thank you. Here's what the, at your direction, Mr. Chair, you asked for me to try to craft a solution on this that might meet the wants and needs of the private independent colleges and also the public ones. And the Dash 13 is what we have come up with. Cindy Hunt cannot hear us right now, but again, she has turned around something in about 4 or 5 hours, which is just phenomenal to me. So all of us ought to thank Cindy for producing these Dash 13s. Here's what they do, Mr. Chair. They keep the basic structure that we have in place today, and I'll just walk through what's basically embedded in these Dash 13s. If a public wishes to move under the Dash 13s, first they would have to notify the private institutions of that desire to expand. Then the private would, utilizing the existing significant adverse impact language that we have in statute today, they could challenge and say that they would challenge that. That would put it into mediation for 90 days. If the mediation is successful, then it's resolved. If it is not, it would go to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission for a 6-month period, and in that 6-month period, the commission would adjudicate whether, and it's on lines page 2, sub C, line 3. If the boards do not resolve the issue, the commission shall approve the program or location if the commission finds that the program or location meets an unmet workforce need in the state. That is it, Mr. Chair. That is the Dash 13s. I thank the private representatives for working with my office, and I also thank the publics for working with my office, and that is what we've come up with.
Thank you. I believe we've gotten nods from both parties. I'd like to Senator Ferriola.
Mr. Chairman, I think the committee owes a debt of gratitude to Senator Deckert for negotiating what I think was a fairly difficult set of issues for a compromise that seems to be acceptable to all the parties. And I appreciate that work. That was an important piece of legislation, and it is. So, just judging by the number of sponsors on the bill, there's a lot of people that think it's an important piece of legislation. So I think, just speaking on behalf of myself as a member of the committee, I appreciate his work.
Absolutely. I also, and I'm very thankful to have such a vice chair to put the heavy labor, heavy lifting off onto, and the results is great. Appreciate it. Senator Marcet?
Well, I think we're saying a little bit. You know, we don't want to...
Don't overdo this.
Yesterday, I can tell you it was...
You're interrupting me, Senator Decker. I'm not through talking about you yet. But this was a situation that I had a very difficult time on because I wavered. I went from one side to the other side and back and forth because it was hard to determine at what point it is justified to do what we're doing. I think you found that point. That's the genius of this, is that I think if there is an unmet labor force need occurring, then that's a trigger. I also want to thank Cindy Hunt, who worked very hard while she was doing your amendments, trying to get my amendments done. So, and she managed to do them both, so I think that's great. But thank you very much for your effort in this. That makes it much easier. Thank you.
Chair would entertain the motion to move the Dash 13 amendments.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ferrioli has moved the Dash 13 amendments to Senate Bill 437. Is Any discussion? Any opposition? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, move the Senate Bill 437 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Or does it have a subsequent referral?
Yes.
And we can just remove the subsequent referral, Mr. Chairman. No, Mr. Chairman, I amend my motion to move the bill with a due pass recommendation as amended to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. Senator Farioli has moved Senate Bill 437 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. Any further discussion? Hearing none, clerk, call and roll.
Aye. Aye.
Vice Chair Decker?
Aye.
Chair Starr?
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, Senate Bill 437 has moved on to its Ways and Means, and I want to thank all who have had a part in working this bill. It's been a work in progress, and I think...
Mr. Chairman, look at all the smiling faces in our audience today.
With that, we close this work session on Senate Bill 437, and we need to get started. This is 510. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 510. And we have three folks signed up here, and we'll just bring you all up. Rodman Heal. Wait a minute, I'm sorry, I see. Let's have the Department of Ed, Bill Autry.
Bill
Audie. Audie and Joni Gillis from the Department of Ed.
You're the sponsor,
Bill,
if you
want to say it. This is a bill that I am the chief sponsor of, at the request of. I believe that the what the measure does is somewhat different than the bill measure summary, and I'm going to defer to Rodney Heal to talk to the bill, and then we will open it up to further discussion.
My name is Rodman Peel. I'm a retired teacher. Appreciate this opportunity to speak to the bill. I've furnished you a packet that has considerable information in it. I would like to speak to my reasons for putting the different things in the packet. First part of the packet refers to my experience as a teacher. Was a few years ago, but I visited with some of my teacher friends, and they tell me many of the same problems that I had are still in existence. And that was one of the main ones, was that teaching sixth grade, I had students that read from first, second up through high school level. For reading, we deployed. We went to the ability levels, the mastery level. For math, we did the same thing. But for the many other hours of the day, we had persons there who it was just virtually impossible to work enough ways around them to be sure that we were giving them the education that they are the instruction they were entitled to. And so we ended up many times, I think, teaching below the level that we should have been giving for the average student, and the higher students were able to go to special classes. The lower students went to special classes sometimes on reading, but other than that, it was really somewhat of a lost basis. The kids that went out of the class, that was kind of interesting. That was one type of thing that one class, I never had to remind them it was time to go, because this meant they got to walk down the halls, go to the bathroom, be in a special teaching and that sort of thing. They didn't seem to increase their ability to operate in the room. I'm sure that they received excellent instruction in there, but at that time at least, the higher level grade teachers were not ones who taught reading as such. Plus the fact it was very difficult to use, for instance, phonics, that sort of thing, in the class without putting the kid down and actually making the child resist the fact that you were trying to teach him. So with this in mind, this was my purpose in asking that emphasis be placed on trying to get some reading mastery. Before this was for all subjects, when this bill was heard before in the House, this time it is only to reading. Now, supporting this idea, well, first, again, I don't dance, which probably is not of a great deal of interest to anybody here, except my wife. She was a little bit concerned about it. But because I don't dance, I don't go to places where I would be asked to dance. In other words, I don't seek out opportunities to dance. But we take the kid who can't read, and he has to go to school. He must go in. And that is a requirement. And so he's placed in an environment where the probability of him having repeated failures occurs each and every day. And if we try to help him, we are, as I said, many times making him feel he's being picked on. And the other kids, unless he's a pretty toughie, are going to be putting him down a tad bit, too. In the packet, I also have in there information from a high school teacher and also information from another upper grade teacher, and they list the problems that they had with people who were unable to read at the level that they were trying to instruct them at. There also is one in there from a teacher of the primary grades over in Brush College. And she lists her class and all the different variations she has. Well, we can we don't need a teacher. We need a person who is a genius, and we need a person who has about a 40-hour day, because there's just no way in the world that you can properly plan for people with the variations they had there. We can do nothing about the social or the economic or the family situation, but we can do something about taking out the variable of them having so many different reading levels, many of which are below the level at which a teacher should be trying to teach. Now, on the back of this package that I gave you, there is something from Heartland, which is a think tank, very conservative. However, even conservatives sometimes do have these things right. And they mention the fact that a child who could not read by the fourth grade at grade level has a very low probability of ever becoming a good reader. Now, they don't quarrel with the fact that retention does not cause a person to learn, but they do mention the fact that no child can really learn to read successfully unless they have phoneme skills, because reading is, in fact, nothing more than code, working out a code in our English language. So the child must be able to have some phoneme skills in order to be an accomplished reader. And if they are not a reader, as I said, by the fourth grade, if they are not reading at level, this bill asks that we do everything that we possibly can to emphasize the reading and have the person reading by the time they're ready to leave the primary grades. Also they list in there the fact that reading is not a natural act. And this is, again, like the code thing. You don't go in reading, just happen to be going along and pick it up and read. You have to learn the skills. It's an unnatural act. There really is no need to ever have it. It doesn't go like creeping to crawling to walking, this sort of thing. It's in this or in this not. So it's only going to be learned when we have somebody there who is teaching and we have some student there who is willing to learn. We do require certain requirements and consequences in many other fields. For driving, for instance, a person must be able to pass the obligatory test. Same thing in hunting. You cannot hunt until you have gone through a hunter safety course. We require helmets for bicycle riding, child seats for children, seat belts. We have all of these different things where we make a requirement, and yet at this time we are allow the children to move up through the grades without requiring mastery at the appropriate grades. Now, for subject matter, we're sure that they get the subject matter and the appropriate grades. But for reading, it just doesn't seem to happen. With this in mind, again, the urgency of the bill seems to me to emphasize the fact that we have children where there is not a wide diversity. Above the fourth grade, we start getting wider and wider diversity. We have them where everybody is receiving a similar type instruction. Let's try to place this such total emphasis on it that we do not bring children on above the third grade into the fourth grade without them having mastered that. Also in this bill is information to be sure that the parents are aware that the child, if he is being moved ahead without, and there is a provision for moving them ahead if they are shown to be unable to do it, that the parent is aware that they're being moved ahead without having acquired the necessary mastery, which is generally proper for that grade. Also in there is the kind of thing that the educational professionals will be the ones who do make the determinations of where the children go. I don't know if it is still true. I know that it was true at the time I was teaching, and that was that if a parent objected to the idea of holding a student or making a student go to summer school, this sort of thing, their decision was the final one. And if we're going to hire teachers at a fair wage, not an exceptional wage certainly, but at a fair wage, and require that they take at least 5 years of college, their determinations as to in what manner the child should advance seems to me that it should be controlling. There is no other area that I know of where the patient has the final say on what, or the customer has the final say on what is done. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to this.
Senator Morissette has a question.
Yes, sir.
Well, it sounds then like this is not a hard and fast rule mandate.
Well, it's do you see it from this side or do you see it from this side? No, I don't see it as a mandate. I see this as setting up that we're going to give in the primary grades extra time if necessary in order to be sure that the child going out of the third grade is reading at that level so that we do not send them on up. Now, that could be looked on as a mandate. Children who have do not have the mental capacity to accomplish this, no, they should be moved in whatever manner the educational professionals feel is appropriate. But I think that we should have a requirement, just as we do in many other parts of our life, that they learn reading before we send them on up into this labyrinth of upper classes.
Let me preface my next question by saying I absolutely, totally agree with you, and you made a lasting impression on me 2 years ago, or maybe it was two sessions ago, when you came before the House committee, and I have used your argument many times, and as a former teacher, I think it's imperative that kids learn, and I think it's important that parents be notified and that they be involved in the decision, so I agree with you. What about second language kids who are coming, and I understand, I think you've already answered that question. There's going to be, it'll be up to somebody to make that determination.
There is still going to have to be somewhere up in the upper grades reading classes taught. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that we now have a very mobile student population. And hopefully if all Oregon does this, well, we won't have a lot of these. But there is going to have to be cases where this is taught. Speaking of second language, that our English-speaking student actually is a student, if they are not taught to read in our schools, and unfortunately they are not taught to read well, are a student or a person who goes through life with no written language. And that is really the truth. Now, we talk about the idea of not retaining students if this doesn't teach them to learn to read. This is possibly true. If I'm driving down I-5 out here at 75 miles an hour with a normal flow of traffic, and I get called over because I happen to drive a Lincoln or I happen to drive something else and get a ticket, this isn't going to do me any good. If I am up here and see a school zone where it says I should drive 20, I'm going to drive 20 in there for two reasons. One reason is the fact that we know that is supervised. The other reason I know that is a very good rule. That is a very intelligent and needed rule that that happens. Well, this to the same thing seems to me that this is what we should do with reading. This is a needed rule. This is something that they have to do. Just like they have to do, learn, they have to pass the driving test before they write. Now, we do practice retention, but we practice it in high school because we do not give a child a graduation diploma unless that child has successfully completed the necessary credits. And so we are practicing retention, but we practice at the, 12 grades too high. We should practice it at the primary level where it would be the most effective, the least costly, and the impact financially, I think, should be no more. We have reading programs now. Let's just orient them to force the child to learn.
It's interesting because my oldest daughter's oldest son was held back in the first grade for a variety of reasons, and it's always difficult to think about that, but he is now working for his PhD. He's been a very successful student and has gone on, and I think that was probably the best thing that happened to him, to not move ahead.
Yeah.
But I understand that retention is not always the answer, but I am totally committed to the idea that kids ought to have to read when they're out of by the third grade.
Right.
And I also feel that parents have to be held responsible. And I noticed in the bill, again, that you work with the parents. They have to be notified
right. That
this is going to happen. It does not apply to special needs students
right. And
special circumstances students, but it does. Right. It's, I think it's great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Peel. I apologize for introducing you incorrectly.
I was so nervous I didn't even notice. You didn't have to do it.
All right. The You did a great job.
Thank you.
Please.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Bill Audie. I'm the Associate Superintendent for the Office of Assessment and Evaluation with the Department of Education, and I'm here representing Superintendent Castillo in opposition to this bill. And I'll speak specifically to some concerns around the, how the assessments are used. Section 9B essentially, it refers to the standards for a third grader, and in Oregon, those are currently assessed and defined by a single test, the reading test. And the standards for use of assessments, educational psychological testing, specifically prohibit making a promotion and actually any placement decision on the basis of a single examination. And so that would be a concern with the language of this bill. Section 9A, which refers to all the grade levels, provides somewhat more flexibility, but there are similar constraints or problems with the standards for use of assessment data. There is also a fairly extensive body of research around the effects of retention, and the conclusion of professionals in that area is that the retention policy seldom accomplishes what it is intended to do, and I'm going to let my colleague speak to that body of research.
For the record, I'm Joni Gillis with the Department of Education. I think, first of all, I need to say that we firmly believe at the Department of Education that it's not okay for any child to not be able to read, and we're doing everything possible that we can to ensure that they have the reading skills necessary for them to open, to continue to open a multitude of opportunities. I will just quickly go over what the research says, and I think you have testimony, and some of the research, the sources are the National Association of School Psychologists, National Research Council, U.S. Department of Education, and I have these studies if you would like them. I didn't copy them for you, but I certainly can get them for you. The most rigorous research that has done indicates that retention and promotion policies, while they're intended to remedy a student's deficits, that in many cases the effect is the opposite. Generally speaking, retention and promotion policies have been ineffective in meeting the needs of academically delayed students. There might be initial growth in that first year when a student is held back or retained, but the research shows that these gains decline within 2 to 3 years, and that studies show that children either do no better or perform even more poorly than similar groups. Research shows that by adolescence, early retention practices are associated with some health and emotional risk factors. One study specifically says, and this was a study done in 1998 of 12,000 students, and found that students that were held back before their eighth grade year were 2 times more likely to drop out than students that had been promoted. Although there are examples of individual students who have benefited from being retained, as a group, the research does not show that that retention is an effective policy. And I think, Senator Morris, you spoke to your grandson, I believe it was. And so in some circumstances, retention or having them stay back, you know, it might be for that individual child, where students have positive self-image and positive self-concept, where they've got good peer relationships, good family supports. In those individual cases, it has been beneficial. But I'm speaking to the scientifically based research. So neither having a student repeat a grade or having them move on to just merely move on to the next grade isn't going to guarantee that a child is going to make academic progress. The research recommends that there be alternatives to retention, and those alternatives are very targeted strategic interventions, much like some of the ones that you spoke about. And so on the back of that sheet that I gave you, I have some interventions that were just discussed, and then I've also put how ODE, how the Department of Education is assisting schools and districts and parents and communities with some of these interventions. So the interventions on the left-hand side came out of the research on retention. The research said just merely retaining a student is not going to get the effect that you want. So here are some suggested interventions. The first one...
Excuse me.
Yes.
I completely agree with you that it's not the holding back, but what you do with the student before that critical time when he's judged underperforming. And afterwards, under Reading First, No Child Left Behind, we have testing it 3 times annually as a part of at least the grant program. Hopefully it's going to roll out to all districts shortly, but in doing that, we're going to establish early where a child's reading level is. The intention of that then is to bring necessary remediation that child then might be brought up to grade level quickly. Not waiting to the end of the year, but 3 times within each year, beginning in kindergarten. That is the kind of intervention that will make a difference. I believe that today, what your research shows is that we are failing the poor, the minority students in America, because we're not educating them. That's what the research really shows. It's what the Commission on Education in 1983 said, America at risk. We're failing those students. They're not performing at the same level, and holding them back does nothing for them unless we teach them. Again, how can we work together to make sure we don't continue to do this? Wait just a moment. Yes, please.
Senator Starr, I absolutely agree with you that there are groups of kids that definitely need more assistance. I think what we're saying is that retaining them is not the answer, but in terms of working together, I tried to list some of those examples. The Reading First grant is an excellent example, and I think the rollout of that as we do the research and the development, and then we assist other schools on this research-based strategy of the 3 times a year testing to see where students are, to see where kindergartners are in first grade and second grade. So by the time they get to third grade, no matter if they're an ELL student, a special ed student, no matter what their background is, they will be successful. We have some initiatives, some programs, some strategies in place. Reading First is just beginning to roll out. We have Optimize, which is another one that is a research based for kindergarten students that we're finishing up this year, and then with the findings that we have from that, we're going to be able to assist other schools and other districts. We have research shows that teachers are the single most important factor in a student's success. So much of No Child Left Behind, the Title IIA money, the Title 2D money, the highly qualified workforce is dedicated. We have a lot of funds that are dedicated to assisting teachers, so that they are more familiar with the strategies to help students be successful.
Yeah, I don't want to take issue with that about teachers, but I think that parents have got to be the very first ones. And I guess the one thing about this that I think needs to be implemented, if nothing else, is that the parents have to be notified. And I'm talking about, and I'm not talking about a special needs student that you identify, but I'm talking about someone that fits that middle norm, and to say to parents, your child is not going to get into reading subject matter until your child knows how to read. And I think that once out of the third grade, you're into the subject matter. And, you know, I just think the parents have to be notified and have to be involved, and I know that some of them are not. They're just not. But, you know, okay, so I don't mean to downgrade the role of the teacher, which is extremely important, but, you know, one of the things about, you know, I went to a private school all the way through college, and I know that one of the private school that I visit, the parents are overwhelmingly involved because it costs so much money. They have to be involved. I mean, they're paying big bucks. And I think that we need to find ways, and I taught all my life in the public system, so, and I support the public system. The only problem in the public system is that parents don't have to be involved. Now, more and more, I think, through parental groups. So I guess the question is there any systematic way that parents are forced to be involved in this program? Now, the way to force them is to say, your child is simply not going to go beyond third grade unless he reads. That's the final hammer. And that is a motivating factor, I think, that parents should have. Now, how are parents involved?
Correct. Senator Starr, Senator Morissette, I believe, I think it depends on the school and the district, actually. I think the school report card has increased parent involvement. I think parents now, it's an excellent communication tool for, it's not about their specific child, but they can see how their school's doing, and I think schools, by and large, are doing a better job at recognizing that parent and community involvement is key to a student's success. We've had several projects. Once again, the information that we've gleaned from these projects are helping us to inform other districts. The High Performing Learning Community is a project that we've done, and then the CSR, the Comprehensive School Review Project. There's a required component. Schools that participate in those projects, a required component is parent involvement. And the schools have reported that their scores have increased. And the parents, you know, it's like night and day. So we're trying to gather this information. And then part of our role at the department is to assist other schools and districts, kind of a research and development, and here are some strategies that can work. Now, we're not going out and saying you have to do it, but we're saying this works, and here's evidence that it works, and try to disseminate that as much as possible.
That's the carrot. There's no stick, and I think that you do need to have some or else. And you know, it sounds terrible, but I think that needs to happen, and I don't see it happening now. You know, in fact, more parents are abrogating their role as parents. I shouldn't say more, but many parents do, to say, hey, I'm not concerned. School, that's what you're there for. You take care of it. And I just think that with the possibility of the student not going on, having been warned three or four times during that year, is, to me, the way to get parents involved.
Mr. Yes. Chair, Senator Morissette, in looking at how we set up accountability, particularly the report card which goes to schools, we have, and more broadly with the system of assessments, we have attempted to set up a medium states assessment system. Mm-hmm. So we do not have, as you're calling for, a particular stick for students. However, we believe that the report card does put attention and allows parents to know how schools are doing. We also report out of the state assessments documents that are translated and sent to parents that explain, here's where your child is, here's what the standard is, and then references. So not to sticks, but we are to being very clear in ways that weren't happening before the statewide assessments. It used to be there were different tests in different places, and it was not particularly clear from the results that you got as a parent where your child was. So that's our intent.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Peel.
I've jokingly remarked that if I'd gone to the Salem schools as a kid, I would never have done anything. because I'd have gotten all the goodies going right on up through, and I would have done only those things I wanted to. And I think that maybe we have some other people who are a little bit that way, too. And so I definitely feel that there has to be something, some consequence that motivates the student to learn. That if you don't learn, you lose a lot of things. Burnt child doesn't touch a stove. A child who knows that there's a possibility he isn't going to be able to go on with his friends is going to have some motivation to master whatever it is necessary, to do whatever it is necessary so that he can go on. And so I think that this is one of the things that it doesn't have to even happen. It just has to be implied so they believe that they have to do these things in order to go on up. Because right now I think there are a lot of children who don't realize that they are failing themselves, because at their level everything happens to them just the same as it did to that person who reads well or does all the other things. And so I do think that we need something that will be motivating, and I think we found in so many areas that the risk of consequences is a motivating factor.
I thank you very much. I would like to comment that it probably is reinforced if the parent also knows that the child has that kind of consequence facing him.
Most important.
And
most
so important. We wouldn't dare to do it without parental notification.
However, after the parent has been notified, then that professional who you've already made go to school for, what is it, 17 years or better, in order to be able to teach in there, that should be the person who makes a decision academically whether or not the child goes. I think the parent certainly needs to be aware, but I think that the professionals, if we are truly professionals, we don't tell the doctor how he's supposed to treat us, and we shouldn't be able to tell the professional teacher how they teach and what, when, how the students move.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Chuck Dent. Yes, please. Yes, sir. We're through with the testimony for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm invited Mr. Bennett to come forward and conclude the testimony. This bill is for public hearing only today, and we perhaps will have further work on it or not. At the moment, we're public hearing only. Mr. Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, I just want to comment on a couple aspects of the bill and a couple of things going on out in the field that might be helpful in listening to the discussion that's gone on around this bill. Generally, we would associate ourselves with the Department of Education's concerns with the bill, but do, Mr. Chairman, want to compliment you on, I know the deep concern you feel for young people in their reading skills, and how do we address the shortfall that seems to occur out there. Our concern, Mr. Chairman, rests in the bill's, perhaps the way the bill would be implemented and how it would come together, what's mandatory, what's already happening, and how would we implement the bill. Looking at the new language on page 2, starting with subsection 8, Ms. Chairman, as I understand it, and certainly I can always be corrected, and am regularly, it seems like, this language in subsection 8 appears to be existing policy, that we do currently have the ability at the local school level to deal with questions of promotion of students for a variety of reasons, including social promotion, and that school districts have individually developed policies for dealing with individual students and how to advance them at various times along the way where the advancement is needed. In sub sub A, beginning in sub A of subsection 8, though, there is a lot of additional paperwork contemplated. It is just a whole batch of new activities being required of districts in terms of documentation, notification, and you can run through the list, written explanation, written plans. We certainly understand, Mr. Chairman, that there is a need as each child is identified with reading deficiencies or any other deficiency in their education. We believe that exists now, but this just seems to kind of be a pile-on of all that. Then when you hit sub B of sub 9, you are adding a nationally norm-standardized reading test to the mix, which is a new and different test than we currently have. We already have state assessments in place that give teachers, we believe, helpful information. We're not convinced yet that there is a need for additional testing outside of the existing program, although certainly no question, if you want to make this guidelines for local districts, suggesting to them that they spend local resources to purchase standard normed and standardized reading tests, that would make sense. But again, we would ask you to look at this as a kind of local guideline, local option, but please not a mandate. In response to comments, and I think really rightly so, Senator Morissette, regarding parent and parental involvement, just to mention a few, parents are notified about their children's progress, and you know this better than I do as a professional teacher. They receive report cards, they have conferences, there are back-to-school nights, there are notes home. Many teachers, particularly in smaller communities, see the parents at the store, at church, at social clubs, fraternities and sororities. The information is going home, and if it isn't, and we have received word at COSA from around the state from a variety of school principals, we developed and are in the first year of a cooperative program with the Department of Education, between the Department of Education and COSA, in a back-to-school project. In that, we are working with the Department of Education to develop and provide materials to parents, encouraging them to come back to school, to come to back-to-school nights, to come to parent conferences, providing a batch of incentive information to them to get them comfortable with the idea of coming back to school. Often you find parents didn't, with kids who are not doing well in school, didn't do well in school themselves or enjoy school. We are providing teachers with a variety of materials that give them ways of dealing with parents through the children as well, encouraging parents, come back to school, talk to us about how your children are doing. We have agendas for this. We are providing also workshops on it. We think we have a very good program. Again, it's in its first year, but we'd be glad to provide you with copies of the kinds of materials we're providing under this cooperative arrangement between our organization and ODE, if that would be helpful, just to show you some of the things we're trying to do right now. It's a voluntary program, but compulsory parent attendance has always been found difficult, and we're trying to figure out a way to entice them back. So thank you very much.
I think everything that you've said is good, and it does work in many cases. I still see the one thing that's missing is a serious charge to the parent that their child may be held back. Everything that you say is received by the parent, and they respond because they're good parents, or they're mostly interested. But my experience is that the kids who are failing, I made parent phone calls to tell them that they're, I had one kid who took my class three times. He really liked my class, and he took it three times because I would not pass him until he met the standards.
Right.
The parents could care less, unfortunately, but I just think that There needs to be more teeth in the, and maybe it needs to be an optional, I don't know. I guess we're talking option right here anyway. I don't see a hard and fast mandate that you shall hold a person back. I think that the schools who develop their tests
can use the tests that they have, but I would like to find a way that puts a little more determination into what we're trying to do. I think if many of the kids who go on, and I don't, you know, you can say all of the good things you want about the successes, but when you look at the actuality in the fourth, fifth, sixth grades, and then get up to the high school level, a lot of kids can't read. They just can't. And there are a lot of good programs like the SMART program where people go into the schools and read and so on. But I don't know if this is the answer, but I think we need something.
Certainly, Senator, Mr. Chairman, Senator, your frustration is shared, I'm sure, by every teacher of reading in the state as they try to encourage a failing child's parent to become more involved in that child's education. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. I think the next bill is going to be a contract with parents that we'll do our part if you'll do your part. Okay. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 510 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 767 and invite up Senator Bruce Starr and Don Phillips, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr, Senator of Senate District 15, representing Western Washington County. Before you is a very simple little bill that relates to the largest unfunded education mandate that the legislature has ever passed. And required the local districts to abide by, even though the bill when it was passed said that they didn't have to implement it without funding. But most have anyway, irregardless of what the statute says. What this bill does would make the SIMCAM program an optional program for our local school districts. They could choose whether or not they wanted to have this program in their local schools. It requires an assessment program in its place in order for us to maintain our the program required by the No Child Left Behind federal requirement. There's been a lot of discussion and debate in this building, I think, about this issue over the past few sessions. And you look at the situation that we're faced with today in our budget situation, and I think it's high time that we look at ways to find to save money. And it's interesting that we ask folks, well, what does it cost the state to have the SIMCAM program, and the numbers that we hear back from the Department of Education are what I would think are interesting numbers, to say the least. I served on the last session on the House Education Committee and had the then Superintendent of Public Instruction testify before our committee and ask the question, what did the SIMCAM program cost the state? And quite frankly, he didn't have an answer for me. He didn't know. Apparently, the department has tried to crunch some numbers to give us an estimate about what it costs. The estimate that I've received from them is $21.6 million. To me, that seems like a pretty low number. A low amount for the amount of effort, paperwork, process that not only takes place in the Department of Education, but also that takes place in the variety of school classrooms all over throughout the state of Oregon. We could debate the pros and the cons of SIM and CAM, whether or not it's a good program or not. I would propose that we not have that debate today, but that we return local control of education back to local school boards. And this bill does that, provides local school boards the option, quite frankly. If at a local level they like this process, they could move forward and continue it. The there's a bill on the House side that the good representative, former Senator Randy Miller, has introduced that goes a bit further than this bill does and basically eliminates the SIMCAM from the statute and then has a outside contractor come up with the assessments, the tests that are necessary for the federal law. In my estimation, either one would be better than where we are today. I think that the representative's approach, quite frankly, is cleaner and simpler. And again, would still return that local control back to our school boards. And if there were pieces of the current education reform that was passed in 1991 that a local school board wished to maintain within their criteria, within their curriculum, I don't believe there would be anything that would prevent that local school board from implementing that at the local level. Again, it's I view this in a large respect as a local control issue. And it just so happens that I think it would save us a heck of a lot of money, too, in a time when we're really looking for those resources. You know, with that, I welcome questions. I think that if in the event that we can find support on this committee for either one of these two bills, I would welcome the opportunity to amend into this bill the representative's bill. And quite frankly, I think it's probably a better approach to the issue. But I'm willing to work with this committee and members of the House to find resolution to this issue. And I, at this point, turn the microphone over to my friend Don Phillips, who's actually done a lot more hard work on this issue as staff to Representative Miller.
Thank you, Senator Starr and Senator Starr and members of the committee. For the record, I am Don Phillips, Chief of Staff for Representative Randy Miller, who is the chief sponsor of House Bill 2415. And we've looked over Senator Starr's bill. It does have a lot of components that mesh with what we've been looking at in 2415 on the House side. And I'll just speak to a couple of issues today that I think that you'll want to touch on as you deliberate this issue. I don't know if you've had a whole lot of hearings on SIMCAM and this committee so far this session, but what you're in for is probably a barrage of positive testimony from the bureaucrats, the administrators who've invested a lot of time and energy in this program over the past 12 years, and you'll probably get an avalanche of testimony and emails and phone calls from parents, teachers, and students who've also invested a lot of time and energy and money and a lot of other things who really don't like this program and want it to go away. I brought just a few samples with me today. These are 200-plus emails that we've received since the beginning of session on our legislation, and only a handful of them are positive in terms of keeping SIM and CAM. The rest want to get rid of it. And so that's just the sample there, and you're welcome to look through them. The House Committee also has a sample of about half of these if you want to just get a sampling of that. I will tell you that we had a website was established by a private nonprofit group just to kind of sample the general public out there on how they felt on House Bill 2415. And in the last 4 weeks, we've had 1,800 people sign up on an online petition using their name, which you very rarely see these days with all the website concerns about security. But let us use their name as a person, a parent, a student, a business owner, a teacher, a principal, who wants to see SIM and CAM significantly modified and eliminated. And you can go to that website and get a sample of who these folks are and who these students are. And I think that's just remarkable to have that kind of grassroots support come forward. We've also seen surveys of some teachers out there as far as these unfunded mandates that SIM and CAM bring with them. And to 80 to 90% of them want these work samples and portfolios and extra testing and paperwork to simply go away. It's just taking up way too much time and energy and money that otherwise could be used for traditional learning, perhaps in the classroom. I will talk a little bit about the benefits or the lack thereof, and that's the question we keep getting from folks. Where is the benefit to SIM and CAM, to this program? Where, after 12 years, are we seeing any benefits? I think you might have seen the Oregon Progress Board's recent 10-year report. If you get to the page on SIM and CAM, you'll see less than 30% of Oregon students are even meeting the requirement right now. And as you look to the future, when they try to target how many students should be meeting it in the future, in the 5- and 10-year benchmarks, the data, it says not enough data to set targets. Our own agency that is supposed to be measuring where we should be in the future can't even give us a guesstimate of where they think we should be because they simply don't know. There's still so much unknown out there about SIM and CAM. As far as where students go after high school, you don't see any of the Oregon colleges put on their application, you must have a SIM to get in here. What you do see in the last year is three of our colleges raised the standards on their GPAs to get in. So GPA is still an important indicator to them, not SIM and CAM. It's been 12 years. Where's the system of higher ed? Where are they on this issue? They continue to say they support it, but none of them require this to get into college. In fact, there was a recent study by the Oregon University System that keeps getting misquoted over and over and over again, and I brought it with me today, and a lot of folks, including the media, have said that the SIM is a better indicator of how a student from Oregon's high schools will perform in college than GPA or SAT, and it's simply not true. When you look at the statistics included in the conclusion of the study, it says that SIM is dead last, SAT is next to dead last, and hands above all the other indicators of how well our students will do in college is the good old-fashioned GPA. And you would probably expect it to be that way because the kids that do excel are those that are tending to be the 30% that are getting the SIM right now. So I'll just throw that out there for you. We have also heard from the business community in the three hearings that we had in the House Education Committee a couple of weeks ago, the business community over and over again saying that they support the SIM and CAM programs. But I've only heard one company mentioned that uses it on their job application. You want to come work for me, you have to have a SIM. You don't hear that from a lot of companies. And I would, if I were you and you hear from the business community supporting this program, ask them this question. If you had a business plan that you had in place for 12 years, and less than 30% of your employees were even following it, or less than 30% of your customers even really came in and responded to it or buy the product that you were trying to promote, would you still have that business plan after 12 years? I don't think so. So I think strictly from a business perspective, you need to ask that question when they come in and testify. And finally, I think it's interesting when you ask, what are the benefits of SIMCAM? What do you get for it? You don't get into college. You don't get a job. Some schools are giving their students little pins that say SIM on it. Well, that's really great. But this is from Sprague High School, and a student brought it in to me the other day. You get a SIMS reward coupon book. And I just picked a couple of the coupons. Here's one for the governor's students for free bowling. Here's one in here for Representative Miller, free golf. And so you get these nifty little coupons. Well, that's great for your summer off. But what happens when the fall comes around and you want to go to college? Does the SIM mean anything? I haven't heard one student say they've been asked on their college admittance form. So I'm just kind of giving you this as kind of some of the information that's come forward in the last month or so that we've had these hearings. As far as the cost goes, Senator Starr mentioned some of the figures that have been tossed around. Representative Miller did ask six specific areas be investigated in the Department of Education as far as where their costs are at, just in the Department of Ed, not in the local school districts. And the report we got back was somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 to $30 million. So when their total budget, all funds considered, is $90 million, you're talking 20% of just the Department of Ed in that rough neighborhood is being consumed by duties surrounding SIM and CAM. We've also had testimony in some of the House Education Committees. One superintendent came in and said, 80% of everything we do in my school district is related to SIM and CAM. Well, you can't have it both ways. You can't go out and tell the media that SIM and CAM don't cost anything and then turn around and say it's 80% of all we do. Well, then it must be 80% of the $5 billion or $4.6 or whatever the number is today of the money that taxpayers are spending on K through 12. I did bring you one thing that I will leave with committee staff, and this is two of the stories out of the paper last Friday. Your own State Board of Education declined to add four new SIM standards, not because the standards weren't great, but because of funding. And as Senator Starr mentioned, and I would call it the mother of all unfunded mandates, So your own Board of Education and your own school superintendent has said, we don't want to go any farther with SIM and CAM because we don't have the money. So they're admitting that this does consume a lot of money. Even if cost weren't an issue this session, which it is, I would argue that $1 spent on SIM and CAM is a dollar too much. It's a waste of time and energy for these students when they could be spending the time and energy doing other things that are more productive and might actually help them in the learning process. And we can talk more about the testing issues. I think that's something that you probably want to get into a little bit farther as you talk about Senator Starr's bill or Representative Miller's bill. But there are options out there for less expensive testing and more effective testing. I know there's been some issues raised about the current testing that the Department of Ed is doing on SIM and CAM. And some critics have said this is like the fox watching the hen house. They're developing the tests to measure their own standards and then telling us the results. We really don't have a lot of good outside auditing to find out if we're really doing as well as we had hoped we would. And so I'm available for questions now or later if you have any, and I will leave the information with your staff.
And if I could make one additional comment, I'm not sure if anybody from the Department of Ed is here to testify on the bill today, but I did have a document that they provided the House Committee dated February 6, 2003, and has an introduction and a background and key findings on the front page. And I just wanted to highlight, this is primarily around the costs, and this is cost estimates from the Department of Ed. But on the third bullet point under key findings, I just find it interesting what they write here, and I think it's important for me to highlight. They say school districts would experience very little direct savings if the SIM were to be eliminated. The majority of the costs identified at the school district level are in small portions of teacher time during the school day. So most cost savings would be indirect, i.e., and this is important, time saved would be available to allot to other activities. In the day and age that we're in today, where you've got class sizes that, due to budget reasons, are going to be increased, if not this school year, next school year particularly, the opportunity for teachers to dedicate time with students, I think, is absolutely critical, and we must not be overlooked. And if they're instead spending time, preparing kids for tests or doing work on portfolios or grading these tests or other things, as opposed to spending that time one-on-one in probably what are overcrowded classrooms, I think that it is important that we look at this issue in a very serious manner and take it very seriously as we deliberate as it relates to our school budgets and the opportunity again to return some local decisions back to our local school districts. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify with you this afternoon.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it very much. And we're going to lose a committee member because he's got other opportunities. And with that, we're going to keep going. Okay. What we're going to do is invite Jill Kirk up.
Mr. Chair.
And Senator George. Senator George, come on up. We're going to have Jill Kirk up. All right. We will be in and out of full committee, subcommittee status, but we're going to continue to receive testimony. Jill, please.
Thank you very much, Chair Starr and Senator Farioli. I am Jill Kirk. I chair the State Board of Education, and I'm sorry that we're taking this slightly out of order. I was expecting to be on a panel with a couple of colleagues from the department, and my role would be really to introduce them with a preface from the board. So I think I'll just go ahead and do that,
okay.
And then they'll come up later. I am, as you may imagine, not in agreement with the testimony that was just received by this committee regarding the value of the standards and the assessments that are currently in place. I think that we have a lot of evidence now that students, with a great help from their teachers, are performing to much higher and important standards than has been the case in the past, and that we see each year a great improvement in student performance. We, as you know, began this large project of improving Oregon's public education system some years ago, and it was in large measure due to direction from the legislature that was undertaken. Also, of course, from the business community, which was dissatisfied with the quality of the knowledge and capabilities of students who were receiving diplomas from Oregon's high schools. Rigorous standards across the traditional academic areas have been put in place, and assessments have been developed by teachers in Oregon to assess students to those standards and to coach them in a deeper learning. And we have found that as each year has passed, more and more students have been able to rise to the challenge that has been set to them. We have recently had confirmation through the report released by the university system, which was referenced by an earlier speaker, which I believe does demonstrate that there is significant value attached to the achievement of these standards or to exceeding the standards by high schoolers. They are, I believe, quite clearly demonstrated by this report to be excellent indicators of whether the students will do well in the university and whether they will persevere in a university career. And further, they get that information at least a year ahead of when they get the predictive information from the SATs. So it gives them time to develop their skills before they move on into the university system. In addition to work and support from Oregon students and Oregon teachers and the business community and the university system, we have received very strong support for Oregon's system of standards and assessments from many other states, the departments of education in many other states, from the federal Department of Education, and from third-party evaluators. On behalf of the board, I would encourage you to consider very carefully the impact of a change to our system. And I know that Bill Oddie and Steve Novick, who are here from the department, will be able to provide you with additional information.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. No questions? We will have your expert witnesses up.
All right. Thank
very
you.
Soon. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, State Senator Gary George representing District 12. And I'd like to have a lot of expert witnesses come who are the parents of students who have called me. And I would like to, if you would, go back with me about 12 years ago. And a friend of ours who was a senator at the time was one of the votes that was cast in favor of the then reform for the 21st century. And I can remember a debate or a discussion we had with him about the vote. And I can remember my wife saying, I believe this is a major mistake. I think this is a real major mistake. Excuse me. I made the statement, no, we need standards. We need mechanisms to test in order to guarantee quality of education. Well, the interesting thing was, I have to admit one more time that my wife was right. She absolutely was right. And I'm going to have to tell you also, Mr. Chairman, about constituents who have called my office. Now, I have about 19 members of my family that have been in the education business that are still teaching or are retired. And whatever time I discuss with them, they're out of this state. When I talk with them about this system, they kind of marvel as to why we would do it, and particularly the money that we alleged originally we were going to have to spend to make it work. But I want to go back to one of the most poignant discussions we ever had relative to this, and it was an immigrant who had moved to Gaston, Oregon, and he had brought his family here because he wanted the better life of America. And one of the things that he would call us about and be so distressed, I cannot express to you the distress that this gentleman would have, as to why aren't the teachers in the classroom and why aren't our students being taught basic skills, you know, that would be traditional educational classes. The person eventually, after about 2 years, and at that time I was serving on the education committee, became so frustrated that we didn't hear from him any further. And I'm just suspecting that maybe he made a decision either to go to another state or go to the country that he had come from, because he was so concerned about the education of his children. Now, I find it kind of interesting what we've been hearing lately about all of a sudden the university discovered that this is a great idea. Well, that isn't what the university was saying a couple of years ago. I can remember being in hearings in which we asked them, what credit or credibility or what requirement do you have that can only be met by a seminary camp? And the answer back then was, well, really none. And we heard the stories this year of students following graduation who got together for a giant bonfire to burn their portfolios. Tells you what they thought about it. But I continually have teachers, and most of them are very guarded when they'll tell you. They don't want to have you know or be seen talking with you about the Simon Cam, that they don't believe it's a very good idea. Now, I'm going to have to tell you, I was absolutely shocked when I heard the number that is being alleged that is supposedly the cost of the Simon Cam. I mean, I couldn't help but laugh, because I want to tell you, we learn in this process that there are people we can believe and people we are maybe a little bit suspicious of. During the last session, and I believe even during the intermediate session, also known as special sessions, I had a chance to get a number that I talked to one of our largest school districts' board chair and the superintendent of that school. And I asked them, do you believe that this number is correct? And it was a substantial percentage of the budget. Do you believe that that's what you're spending to run this program? And I just noted a couple of days before, had the article with me, that they had just laid off three or four people that were just relative to setting up and operating the Simon Cam within their district. And the answer from both of them was, yes, I do believe that number's correct. Well, it's over 10 times the number that was given recently, alleging that that was the cost of the Simon Cam process. If you'll notice in Section 2 in line 10-11 of this bill, it says that we shall adopt and administer nationally recognized norm preference academic achievement testing. Now, that's an important line, because one of the things that I've discovered as I've watched the Simon Cam is that we really seem to enjoy inventing the wheel every year or two. We started off with a set of tests. We didn't like those, so we changed those. And then we did change it again, and another set of wheels got invented. And all of a sudden, we come up to the conclusion that maybe we should look at some national recognized testing systems that we know work. You have a reference point. I can compare student A with student B in this state and other states. So I'm going to urge you to support this or the other bill that's being described, the House bill, because something has to happen. And if nothing else, give my districts an opportunity to say yes or no. Because I honestly believe now, as one more time I'm going to say this, that my wife was right. This was really a bad idea. We cannot any longer afford to continue a bad idea. Thank you.
Question? Thank you, Senator George. And now, Bill Otte and Steve Novick.
How many more do
we have? A couple more.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I'm Bill Otte from the Office of Assessment. And what you have in front of you is brief testimony relating specifically to this bill, and then some other general information about the assessment system, since that's clearly one of the issues that's surrounding this bill. First to 767, one of the concerns we have is that as written, the bill would not allow Oregon to meet the requirements of No Child Left Behind, specifically the requirements that all students be tested. So national norm reference test that is in the bill is excluding students with disabilities and limited English proficient students. And those are particular subgroups for which the No Child Left Behind requires the students test and make progress. So that would be a problem in terms of federal law with this. Having And then if we make the state assessment, the existing assessment system optional, again, we would not assess all students. The one of the other things to point out is that the bill, as it's written, goes beyond the requirements of No Child Left Behind in testing every grade, kindergarten through 12th, where No Child Left Behind requires 3 through 8 and then once in the high school. So there's a significant cost involved in testing at the additional grades. Third paragraph is a reference to there's an expansion of the report card, which has to do with characteristics of classrooms. Collecting that information would be a significant burden on teachers in the schools as they are, because currently the report card does not address specific characteristics of classrooms. So there'd be a new collection and reporting requirement there. Generally about the assessment system, let me say it this way. No Child Left Behind, when the federal government was debating the Congress this bill, they considered whether there should be a national curriculum and a national test, and specifically excluded that possibility. And also, there was another talk about there's something called the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is being given across states at a sampling basis, not every student. And they talked about, should all the tests and standards be aligned to that? And they said no. The requirement of the bill is that each state write its own content standards and then construct, adopt tests that measure those standards, which is what we've done in Oregon. As it stands, there's no other test in existence that could measure Oregon standards. The federal law and the guidance is very clear that if a state is to adopt a national published norm reference test, the publisher must augment it, adapt it, essentially go through the process that we've already gone through of picking, maybe writing new items that match our content standards. So there's a considerable expense that, essentially repeating what we've done over the last 12 years in Oregon in adopting a publisher's test. There is auditing of our assessment system. We have a number of audits. There are two, the U.S. Department of Education specifically did review our assessment and has approved it for purposes of No Child Left Behind. As a matter of fact, if we are to change anything, we must notify them and re-go through the process again to make sure that assessment is acceptable to them. Independent agency Achieve, which is a bipartisan nonprofit group, has looked at Oregon assessment system and the standards, and actually in the latest release identified Indiana and Oregon as exemplars of clear, concise, well-written standards that are well assessed. The contracting. Essentially, if you look at since there is no existing test, taking a nationally norm test is not a process of just going and buying it. We would essentially contract with that publisher to construct a test for us and then to administer it. We already contract out most of our testing. We contract out the printing, the shipping, the scoring of the multiple choice items, and we have put those out to bid, and we specifically notified all of the publishers and said, would you like to bid on this part? And we've chosen the lowest bidder for that. So we believe that what we have done is very economical. What we haven't contracted out is the writing of the test items. We have Oregon teachers do that. We think that causes a very strong match between the content standards and the assessments. There's also a validity in that those teachers say, well, yeah, I was involved in writing that test. I know what that match is.
Yeah. Thanks. Sorry to interrupt.
Certainly.
You're talking about local involvement and so on. Has the department ever done a cost assessment with the districts? Have you ever asked the districts to separate out costs for various programs? And, you know, we heard a lot about how much a district is spending, 80% or whatever, on SIM and CAM and so on. Have you ever attempted to compile information?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, are you asking specifically about the assessment program and its cost?
Well,
I guess I'm talking about the cost of writing. You were saying you write your own tests. Okay, now there's a cost of writing your own tests. The cost of implementing the SIM and the CAM. Now, if you didn't do the SIM and the CAM, you would be doing something else that would also cost probably as much or maybe not as much, but I'm trying to get a handle around the previous testimony that talks about how much it cost to administer the program. Now, I know you have to separate them out and then figure out what you would replace it with, which would also cost.
Okay. Steve, do you have a... Mr. Chair, Senator Morrison, the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators recently actually sent out a survey to their members asking about the cost of having this assessment system, and the figures they got back were that it would cost on an annual basis about $6 million to administer the SIM and $4 million to be involved with the CAM, and they noted in their survey, which we'll provide a copy of to you, that although there are some districts who have a larger districts who have a full-time SIM CAM coordinator, to a great extent those costs reflected the time of teachers in administering the tests and being involved in preparing for the tests. The department put out its own study relying largely on what the Confederation of School Administrators got in return in response to their survey. The department's figures actually were somewhat higher, in part because many of the districts wrote back that there is no cost. We wouldn't save any money by eliminating this program because the work is all done by teachers who would exist anyway. And Nancy Heiligman at the department, who did our study, decided, well, there is some cost in terms of time, so we're going to figure out what that is and assign a cost to it. So if you look at the two studies, which we will deliver to you, the department study says that the cost is about, I think that the projections were about $15 million in departmental cost for having an assessment system and about $35 million in district costs for a biennium for actually doing the work. So the figures that the department got were somewhat higher than the figures COSA got because the department decided there is some cost to every district in terms of time.
May I ask one quick follow-up? Was that information given to the House Committee on Education? Is this something that... Okay, so that's
yes, it was
part of that. So we will be getting that information.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, I'd like to respond a little bit about the test development.
I'm sorry for interrupting.
That's quite all right. The part of, understand the history over time, the 1989 legislature was the one that commissioned the statewide assessment system, and so there was perhaps more work at the initial stages for developing it. Now, our primary source of adding new items, and as we've evolved standards, there's always a little bit of new items to write over time, but it's handled mostly during the summer, and it is a sort of a volunteer, we ask teachers to participate, and then we pay them a fairly minimal amount. It's out of our budget, not out of teacher time in classrooms. And most teachers find it to be a very rewarding activity in terms of understanding the standards that they're to teach. So that is sort of about the development piece. We also don't contract out for scoring the performance assessments, writing and math problem solving. We ask teachers to do that, and again, they do it on their own time. We pay them 18-something an hour, and we give them no lunch break. We work them fairly hard, but they also report that this is a very useful opportunity to read papers from around the state and to have a better understanding of the performance standards. So that's something that we think, is very important for Oregon teachers to be doing, and we do not want to ship the papers out someplace else to be read. The information on the back of this page didn't come up earlier today, but there's often been time around the assessments. What you see in the 0102 chart is the actual, those are from our manual, so that's the time it takes to give the tests. And it generally comes out to, even if you double that time to allow for some preparation and managing of materials, it's less than 2% of the instructional time during the year. And as you see, looking ahead to when we're implementing new tests, we still don't have a large percentage of time taking up during the year for the state testing. The next two pages are a very quick comparison between the costs of two ITBS, Iowa Test of Basic Skills, is one of the major publishers of tests. Just looking at their website and what it would take, $8 to do reading and math, our estimate is $6. So if you look at the last year, that's a savings of $1.1 million over using a publisher's test. And that publisher's test, the costs that are included there don't count any of the adaptations that would have to be made to make that test viable with the No Child Left Behind requirements. The last page looks at the writing assessment, which is a more expensive because of that writing. And at this point, we're comparable. But again, we think it's important to have Oregon teachers and to do that. And there's a training component that is very important. And so we think that's a worthwhile investment. And I can lose the testimony if you have any questions.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
No questions. Steve.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, my name is Steve Novick. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Department of Education, and I once spent a wonderful week in Montana.
I have many relatives in Montana, Helena, Missoula.
Great.
I provided the committee a copy of the testimony of Pat Burke, Deputy Superintendent for Policy. Mr. Burke couldn't be here today, but this is his testimony before the House Education Committee on a SimCam-related bill, and I thought it hit some points which were relevant to this bill as well. Essentially, they relate to the relationship between Oregon's system of assessments and any proposals to change those and the federal law, No Child Left Behind. I would submit that Oregon system, as the senators know, the SIM is simply a reward, as it were, for students meeting the standards that the state has set on our system of assessments. And I would submit that Oregon system of assessments is nationally recognized because, in fact, it has been recognized by the nation itself. And attached to Mr. Burke's testimony is the letter that the department received, the United States Department of Education, on June 28, 2001, saying, "I am pleased to provide full approval for Oregon's final assessment system. Congratulations on a fully approved assessment system." And that accepted Oregon's assessment system for purposes of No Child Left Behind. Oregon is one of 19 states with an assessment system fully approved for No Child Left Behind. We've also attached a couple of pages that are particularly relevant from the federal law itself. And I want to point out that the federal law states that any state desiring to receive a grant under this part, that meaning Title I, shall submit to the Secretary a plan developed in consultation with local educational agencies, teachers, principals, etc., that satisfies the requirements of this section. It states that the state shall have academic standards for all public elementary school and secondary school children for subjects including math, reading or language arts, and science. And as Mr. Audi suggested, this means that if we have a system that is optional or a system that is not for all students, then it's not in compliance with No Child Left Behind. And I've also attached the provisions of the law that demonstrate that on the back page that there are significant penalties for not having an assessment system in place. Thus, we are, in effect, required by the federal law to have an assessment system in place. The system developed for the SIM does meet those requirements, and we cannot, without significant additional effort, simply replace it with another system. We couldn't just, the Department of Education couldn't just decide we want to buy some tests from some publisher and that's our new system. We would have to demonstrate that we had adopted a new system of assessments in consultation with local educational agencies, teachers, principals, and so forth. This is, as Mr. Audi suggested, I think we believe that it would cost a significant investment of additional time and resources to get rid of this system and adopt another. I also just wanted to comment on Ms. Phillips made reference to the testimony that the House Committee heard on Representative Miller's bill, and I would encourage the committee to have a series of hearings if you're planning to move ahead with this bill, as the House Committee did. There was extensive testimony from a wide variety of people, and I think there are a fair number of folks who came in and said this is a bad system, get rid of it. There are a fair number of folks who came in and said this is a great system that's had real educational benefit. I recall one student who came in from David Douglas High School who came in at the hearing the committee had at OMSI, who, in response to the question, do the colleges care, she said, you know, I applied to a college in Washington State, and they'd never heard of the SIM in the CAN, but when I explained it to them and described the experience I had with our SIM program, they thought it was a great thing, and they said that that would factor into their decision on whether to accept me. So this is not a system that all students, as some I think have suggested, uniformly reject, or all teachers. And what the heck else was I going to say?
you were going to say we should take a look at the IOWN school district.
Yeah.
I'll stay far away from that one, Senator.
No, because they're the highest achieving district in the state.
Oh, I was completing my list of, we had a balance, but there were folks that said get rid of the system. There were folks that said it's a great system, hang on to it. We also had a large number of physical education teachers who were very distressed at the idea that, as proposed in Representative Backlund's bill, physical education would be removed as a mandatory part of the SIM. So it was quite a mix of opinions that committee heard.
Well, ask a quick related question.
Yes.
So will social studies, according to, I mean, in fact, I think Representative Backlund has a bill that would narrow the SIM in the CAM to three core subjects. Will that have an impact on the national standards if we cut the SIM and CAM in half?
That's an excellent question, Senator Morissette. In fact, the State Board of Education and Representative Backlund and Representative Miller were all moving towards a model where the only mandatory subjects for the SIM would be the same subjects that are mandatory for No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind requires assessments in math, reading, writing, you know, English language arts, and science. And currently, the only parts of the SIM that have been fully implemented everywhere are those precise subjects.
Oh.
And the plan had been to expand that to where required subjects would include arts, second language, social science, and physical education.
So much for teaching local government and state government, right?
Well, so it's certainly the board's hope that the teaching of local and state government would not be abandoned, simply it would not be a necessary part of the SIM.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're running over time here. I'm thinking that we better have two more witnesses come up, Chuck Bennett and Morgan Anderson.
Okay. Well, good evening. Thank you for staying a little later and being willing to hear all testimony today. My name is Morgan Anderson, and I'm with Intel as their education manager for the state of Oregon, and I'm here to testify in opposition of Senate Bill 767 and ask that our state assessment system, including the SIM and CAM certificates, remain as they are and not made optional. I'd like to remind the Senate committee that a decade ago, we had tests that showed that our students were not performing competitively with their international peers. There was a report, which you mentioned earlier, Senator Starr, titled A Nation at Risk, came out in 1983, that showed students were performing well below in all subjects than their parents had even performed a generation earlier. While schools did test our students annually using standardized tests, we found that this methodology was not enough to propel students to achieve high standards. Industry, including Intel, saw the lagging results of our school system and asked for higher standards. Like many other states, Oregon was not alone and moved away from just using standardized tests and created one of the most progressive systems in the world with SIM and CAM. And I know that we get calls from all over the world looking to replicate much of what we have at SIM and CAM. I personally get calls because I've been involved with helping implement it at local schools. Our system of assessments provides students continuous feedback on how they're performing and where they need to improve. It holds students accountable for reaching high standards, and what I feel is most important, it demands knowledge retention beyond the next test. So what has a decade shown? Well, we've made huge improvements, and looking at just 10th grade student results, the most recent results, 22% more are meeting standards in reading than a decade ago, 11% more are reaching math standards, 50% have met the math problem-solving component compared to only 23% a decade earlier. This is more than 100% increase in math problem solving. Nearly 26% have reached all of the requirements necessary to earn a SIM. Surely this is not as high as it should be or will be, but it's critical to note that we have seen increases, some quite dramatic, in students earning their SIMs. And in school districts that have completely embraced the system, the results are truly outstanding. I'd like to point to the school district of Powers, where 1 year, 100% of their students received their SIM, just last year, I believe. I want to reference a comment where a school administrator had spoken with Representative Miller and stated that 80% of what they do is related to the SIM. I think that the quote was taken out of context. I don't believe, because I was at those hearings, I don't believe that the individual said that 80% of what they pay for relates to the SIM. It's 80% of what happens in the classroom relates to the SIM. And I would like to say that it should be nearly 100%, because we shouldn't be testing kids on things we don't teach them. The difference with SIM is that teachers don't write the test. We have our state that's written the test so that there's consistent education delivery given to all students throughout Oregon, so that we know that what one student is learning in one classroom, that another student across the state is going to get the same content delivered to them. And the schools that have truly embraced this program and have made sure to align all of their curriculum and not try and squeeze pieces of what their students are going to be tested on the SIM exams and on the performance standards, and try and still teach a favorite unit that may not be as relevant to their students and what they actually need to know to be successful in today's society. So,
May I?
Please.
Yeah, you're really pushing my buttons here.
Okay.
Because I taught for 30 years in high school, and I just thank God that I taught before they even got the SIM in the CAM, because that's teaching to the test, and I think there are a lot of relevant things that are going on, and I'm not advocating getting rid of the SIM and CAM, but I know that teachers teach to the test, and I don't know that that is real learning. Now, there are a lot of life experiences that they have to go through, which is good, but I think that we lost a lot. You know, they've eliminated a lot of very good programs because of the SIM and CAM. And, you know, you're zeroing in, and it's a...
I hear what you're getting, and that was not my intention to say that we should only be teaching to the test. My intention is that there should be a core set of content that we feel all students should have delivered to them, so that what we feel is critical for students to be able to demonstrate performance, that they have the opportunity to have that instruction in their classroom and be able to show and demonstrate that they are proficient in that. Not to say that there aren't other ways of... not to say that you should only teach the test. And I think it's important to point out that our assessments are not a multiple choice only assessment. And if that's all it was, I would be as equally concerned as you are, Senator Morissette, because multiple tests is, while it can be helpful, it's very limiting. And I think what's fabulous about our SIM program is that students have to show and demonstrate proficiency in other ways besides a multiple choice test.
Senator Morissette.
Okay. Something that wasn't mentioned earlier was the SAT scores and the SAT tests, which cover a lot of material which colleges do pay attention to.
Yeah.
That's extremely high. Grade inflation is prevalent in many schools, and to me, a 3.25 GPA does not qualify a person for college unless they have corresponding SAT scores. And I think that that to me shows achievement. Now, the SIM and the CAM, I think the experiences and some of the things that they do are important. I'm not sold on the SIM and CAM. I'm not sold on getting rid of it either. I mean, I'm looking at the evidence and so on, but having taught for many years, I see the success. And looking at the success of the school system of kids who have gone on to college and have done great things, we have a good system. This, in spite of the SIM and CAM, I'll say it that way. So.
Yes, thank you. And
well, I would just like to make one other point. That there was a question, and I thought it was a very valid question, on how businesses are demonstrating the value of SIM. And I would like to state that at Intel, we have that on our application for scholarships and for internships. We have 150 high school scholars with us annually. We have 72 scholars with us in college. And so we do care whether they earn their SIM.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I just wanted to comment on a couple of things. Mr. Chairman, I really want to recommend to you and the committee a complete review, if you have the time, and I understand the limitations on your time, but a complete review of the record from those House hearings. It's really quite a remarkable record. I sat through most, you've got the whole shebang. It really is an interesting set of information, and I think you'll find, and I can just assure you that this is not one of those let's bring out the troops events. This was a free will offering of information, I think, from folks, whether they were administrators, teachers, students, critics, supporters. It didn't matter. We did not have the Lars Larson show advertising it to the world to come on down. But I think you'll find that when Oregonians were given an opportunity to come in and talk about this system, in a vast majority of them spoke highly of the SIM-CAM system. The problem I think you have when you look at whether or not you're going to make a program like this optional is you have so integrated this so completely. It is our educational system. If someone says it costs 80%, it's because that's what we do. And it is not teaching to the test. I want to just sort of, let me try an idea on you, see if you buy it. I won't give you my Montana stories, but I'll give you my idea on this. In Oregon, teachers are teaching to standards. We talked about standards in health. They're measured. The success they have in achieving students approaching the high-quality standards we have in the state is measured by the assessment. But there is a standard in there that is what the teacher is teaching to. They're not teaching to the assessment. The assessment is purely there to determine whether or not the student has achieved these high standards. And I think that it is a true distinction. I believe there is a difference. I understand teaching to a test. I think any of us who grew up in the 50s and 60s know what teaching to a test is like, and this is a different idea, I think. I do want to suggest a couple things about the bill, that if you do decide to proceed, instead of using the House bills, which I think are something's coming your way on SIM and CAM, I'm sure, whatever it is. I know you're waiting. But I think that until you've had the kind of hearings the House has had, it's hard to appreciate kind of all of the information out there, and you aren't going to ever hear it from me. I can't assimilate it all. But I really think there was an interesting record created. You're going to add some costs and just a couple of problems with the bill. I think when you start looking again at administering tests to students in grades 1 through 12, you are adding substantially to our existing testing requirement. When you require us to test all private school children, you are adding substantially to our costs for testing. These are not things that exist today. By leaving SIM-CAM optional, you are not relieving the department anyway of its costs. They still have to maintain everything associated with the assessment system and the standards, whether it's optional or not. And I think, finally, the biggest concern we have, and I know you know this, but out in the field, No Child Left Behind created a lot of fear and trembling, and the realization that we have an assessment system, a set of standards, standards and an assessment system associated with it that meets No Child Left Behind and allows us to proceed in an orderly fashion without massive disruption is extraordinarily attractive. And did I mention a time of declining revenues? Did I mention
no,
the $4.6
no,
billion? No, I wanted to catch
you. Okay, thank you.
But it is really important that you not look for a way to disrupt education in the state at this time. Thank you very much.
I appreciate that, and we will with certainty look at the House passed bills. I would say thanks to those who persisted and stayed with us. I told my committee I wasn't going to do this very well. I told them I wasn't going to try to stay after ours. We're going to have another day. So starting next week, we're going to meet Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday instead of just Tuesday, Thursday. And that will be published. We will try to fully hear the bills, bring back those that are worthy. Again, I think this is an important discussion. My problem is, in spite of all the glowing reports, colleges today are telling me we're remediating 25% to 30% of all of those who enter college. These are the best trained students. The community college, which is getting older students in larger numbers, remediating 80% of students, indicating that maybe over time we've done some good, I think. But still we're not somehow aligning our graduation requirements with college preparation requirements. So I'm interested to work with you. Hope you can work with me to see what we can do to improve schools in Oregon. With that, I thank you. Close the hearing. And